If I'm a nation, I'm a lot less concerned about building a treasury of Bitcoin than I am about solidifying my economic sovereignty in the long run. And I get that by controlling block space. Because if you wait for it, you'll be too late. We have to stay vigilant. And this certain amount of paranoia, I think, is really important.
What Bitcoin Did is brought to you by our lead sponsor and massive legend, Iron, the largest NASDAQ-listed Bitcoin miner using 100% renewable energy. Iron are not just powering the Bitcoin network, they also provide cutting-edge computing resources for AI, all backed by renewable energy. So whether you're interested in mining Bitcoin or harnessing AI compute power, Iron is setting the standard. Visit iron.com to learn more, which is iren.com.
So I think we're at a very interesting point in Bitcoin, mm-hmm. in that there's so much good news.
Yep.
And strategic Bitcoin reserves, some corporate adoption, the ETFs. And what I detect is some complacency and comfort.
Yes.
That bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think we're safe. I don't think the problems are all solved. I don't think we're immune from attack or from even being wounded severely. Mm-hmm. We may have reached the point where Bitcoin won't die.
Yep.
But will the Bitcoin that we want live? Like, those are two different things.
I completely agree. And this is something that, so first of all, like, I've heard many times before people say, like, the biggest threat to Bitcoin is complacency. And that's something I totally agree with. And this is why I've really struggled to kind of round out my ideas of whether all this, like, you're not going to stop this nation state adoption. So that's irrelevant. But whether it's a good thing, whether that's going to mean we get the Bitcoin that we want, I'm still not sure where I am with that.
Yeah, it's really a dilemma. That's mm-hmm. probably not the right word, but yeah, you kind of feel it on both sides and, yeah. you know, probably talk about it in a little more depth later. But I think you're right. We can't stop nation state adoption. And I think we'll probably talk about it in a little bit. I don't think we can stop nation state adoption, even in control of the chain itself.
Mm-hmm.
What we have to do is find a path to create a section of the ecosystem that yeah. maintains all the things that we hold near and dear, immutability and borderless and censorship free and all that.
Yeah.
Because the big boys are coming, and it's not just the nation states, it's the big financial institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're on the cusp of realizing that it's not just owning Bitcoin that's important, it's the ownership of the network that is important. And,
yes.
and the heart of the network is in mining and in block creation.
Mm-hmm. And this is why what you're doing at Ocean is so important. And we will get into all of this. But thank you for driving all the way over here for this. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I love seeing you.
Life's pretty hard for miners right now.
It is.
Is the hash price just about all-time lows?
It is.
So how are you guys getting on at Barefoot?
Well, I think what it does is it pushes, one, the Darwinian
yeah.
component, right? You know, we're going to see fallout.
Yeah.
Now, will that be big boys falling or small guys falling? You know, hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what I will say is I think the small guys, the nice thing about being smaller, and you've probably heard me talk about rabbits and horses and elephants and that yeah. sort of stuff before, is that we're more nimble, so we can pivot, I think, more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
For me, survival in this world will come down to energy production.
Yeah.
Not finding low-cost energy, but producing your own energy.
Oh, interesting.
I think that is really the only path to being sure that you have the economic structure that will survive.
That's interesting. And that's what Gridless are now trying to do in Africa, isn't it? They want to go and actually own the energy infrastructure yeah. at the source. And then you can Correct. Kind of put co-locate mining there for now. And maybe in 10, 20, 30 years, maybe there's no mining at that site.
Right.
But you just keep moving on, moving on, right. moving on.
So I think what happens, and I know there's a lot of topics we'll probably hit, is I think you build your mining organization from the bottom up, not the top down.
Yeah.
And let me explain that for a second. I think there's something I call the miner stack. Okay. So it starts at the very bottom. There's kind of two components in the foundation. One is energy production, and one is ASICs, the chips. Okay. And then you go up a step and you have the system production, not the chip, but the system production. Then on top of that sits the kind of operational efficiencies and like those sorts of things, like to hash, to be a hasher. And then the next level up is the block creation itself. And so you kind of build this thing up. And I think what's happened is what most people think of as mining is just hashing. It's kind of the middle piece. That's the hardest area to build differentiation and build value.
Okay.
So we have almost everybody focused in this one area. And I'll explain why in a second. But I think everybody's been focused there. And they miss a couple things that one, that's not mining. In fact, I think I'm getting somewhat vigilant about saying for organizations that only do that, we have to stop calling them miners.
So these are the people that will hash with a pool that they're not controlling the block template of.
Well, they kind of sit in the middle. They don't produce energy.
Yeah.
They build an operation, big or small. They hash for a price.
Yep.
So I like the word abdicate, because I think traditionally a miner, the role of a miner is to run a node, manage a mempool, create block templates, construct the Coinbase transaction, receive Coinbase payments. By Coinbase, I'm sure you know. I'm not talking about the company. I'm talking about the actual payment of Bitcoin from the block itself, and the hash. And what's happened is we've migrated, right or wrong, actually I shouldn't say right or wrong, wrongly. We've wrongly allowed the pools. I'm not saying they were necessarily malicious in the way that they approached it, but we've gotten to the point where the pools are doing everything but the hashing. And there aren't that many pools. I'm sure we'll talk more about that later. But the organizations that are just hashing, they're really, what they're doing is I call them mercenary hashers. That they're performing this function that sits really in a kind of the middle ground of this mining stack that I talked about, adding very limited value, in my opinion. Probably the least amount of value is being added at that point in the stack. And they're letting the pool take control. And so by doing so, there's a tremendous amount of power and responsibility that now becomes the traditional pool's job. Now, at Ocean, we're doing something a little different. But the pool is creating the templates. People,
before we do that, I want to get into the pool. I don't want to end up going back and forth too much. I did just want to touch on one thing. You were talking before about you think we're going to start seeing some fallout in the mining industry. I mean, people said that around the halving, and there was a couple of consolidations, but we've not seen real big fallout. We've not seen many companies go bust. What do you think would lead to that? Is that people who are kind of missing the full stack and are just doing the hashing? Do you think they're the ones that are likely to struggle?
Ultimately, yes. And I can't predict what'll happen tomorrow. Yeah. But I can say that, we'll back up a little bit. So I think if you ask somebody what has been the role of the miner for the last 16 years.
Yeah.
Most people would probably reply, it has been to produce Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. The issuance came through the miners, right? They were working for the subsidy. And I think a lot of people's perspective about the incentive structure of miners, what incentives do they have You'll hear a lot of people talk philosophically about these natural equilibriums, like, hey, if X happens, then and it starts looking bad, don't worry, because Y will happen to make it all better again.
Yeah.
You know, like this beautiful constructed thing. And it is a beautifully constructed system. But I think that equilibrium only works in a fairly small controlled environment where the incentive is so simple, mm-hmm. like the subsidy. We're at the point now where the subsidy has dwindled, right? We're at 6% of the original subsidy.
It's becoming less and less relevant.
And we all know what's coming,
yeah.
right? And so the output of the Bitcoin mining process will shift from producing Bitcoin to producing block space.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the product. Hence, that's why I say, maybe it fills in a blank from what I was saying before. If all you do is hash and you've abdicated the power to do the other function that is really the key value, what function are you really performing?
Yeah.
So I think what's happened is holistically, if we look at the big known bigger name companies that have performed that function, they're pivoting away from Bitcoin.
So this is like them issuing debt to buy Bitcoin rather than mine Bitcoin. Is that what you're talking about?
That would be one example. Mm-hmm. The other example would be, hey, let's convert our access to energy, grid-based energy,
yeah.
to a place that will pay us more money for it, like AI and HPC.
Mm-hmm. And what about demand response? Would that fit into that as well? Or do you think that's just a natural?
Well, I think that's a natural thing. I think one of the interesting things about mining is I think we oversell those types of things. And I'm very much a contrarian.
Do you think we oversell them because it's so good for the narrative?
Oh, it's wonderful for the narrative.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it is untrue, but it can only be true to a certain extent. So mm-hmm. like, let's look at a couple numbers. I think these are good numbers for people to have. Global electronic energy consumption is about 30,000 terawatt hours. That's everybody.
Yeah.
Everything, all the lights, all the cameras, all the whatever, right? I believe the Bitcoin network is consuming about 200 terawatt hours annually.
Okay.
Okay. So we're 0.6% of global energy consumption.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the entire Bitcoin network last year in dollar terms produced about $14 billion. Okay. So
this is subsidy plus fees.
Subsidy plus fees, about $14 billion. Okay. All of us participating in this shared $14 billion of revenue. We can't buy enough energy to on a global basis, affect all the grids. Mm-hmm. We can't even do it for the US. Can we do it when we have such a massive concentration in Texas? Yes, we can make a material impact on that.
Yeah.
But I think we, like I said, I think we oversell it because we can't balance all the world's grids. We can't be baseload and curtailment and all this for everybody. We mm-hmm. can just do it. We can do it in select places. It will have a positive impact on humanity. So all that is true. But I think it's highly oversold. However, and I'm going to try to visually describe a chart here. Okay. If we go back to that 30,000 terawatt hours of energy, of electricity, excuse me. Now imagine an x-axis, which is the price of that energy per kilowatt hour. And the y-axis is the amount of energy consumed at that price. Okay. What you'll find is it's roughly a bell curve with 15 cents per kilowatt hour at the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So given that, now you move to the lower left corner, the origin, okay? That would be where it was zero cost energy. Okay. Well, and there's a little bit, like you said, like in demand response, you could actually say, well, there's points where energy is actually negative on the grid, right? So that, but anyway, in mining and hashing, actually probably a better way to say it, in hashing, there's a number between 4 and 5 cents per kilowatt hour at a commercial level. If you're not at that level, you're out of business.
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you think about the bell curve, we're really far from the middle. So my estimate, and it's very hard to get a real number, but my estimate is that maybe there is 1,500 terawatt hours of energy available at the right price.
Mm-hmm.
And we're using 200 already. Okay, we're using 200 of it. We have to fight HPC, high performance computing, traditional heavy industry for that amount of energy.
Yeah.
Okay. And all the low hanging fruit is largely taken. Now, will new energy come onto the grid? Sure.
Of course, yeah.
Will there be some additions there? Sure. But to go out and build a 200 megawatt, a 400 megawatt, a gigawatt kind of facility, it gets really, really hard to find those kind of spots on grid.
Mm-hmm.
So you asked me earlier how we compete. We compete or survive, I think is actually how you asked. But how do we survive? Which I guess surviving and competing are the same thing.
Yeah.
in our world. We can go out. So for instance, we have access to natural gas wells.
Mm-hmm.
Often we own them. We own our own hydroelectric facility. We have an anaerobic digestion facility. Now, these might be 1 megawatt or 3 megawatts or 5 megawatts or 0.5 megawatt, but we can achieve costs down, let's say, in the 2 to 3 cent per kilowatt range, potentially even cheaper, but only in that size.
Yeah.
By producing our own energy. And so that's how we can survive. And it's by... because there are pieces out there, almost an infinite number, right? I mean, there's water flowing and natural gas and cow shit, you know, whatever. There's an infinite supply of all that stuff. Yeah. And we can build power production from that competes. But we just can't do it at 50 or 100 megawatts,
yeah.
Individual sites. We have to build small sites. And so that's what we're getting good at. How do we, that's my organization at Barefoot is, you know, how do we do that? Well, we learn how to manage a whole bunch of different small sites and produce our own energy.
This episode is brought to you by AnchorWatch. The thing that keeps me up at night is the idea of a critical error with my Bitcoin cold storage. This is where AnchorWatch comes in. With AnchorWatch, you're protected by their time-locked multi-sig vault and with your own A-plus rated Lloyd's of London-backed insurance policy. You get to hold your keys, AnchorWatch holds the risk. Whether you're worried about inheritance planning, rent your tax, natural disasters, or your own mistakes, you're protected by AnchorWatch. Rates for fully insured custody start as low as 0.55% and are available for individual and commercial customers located in the US. Speak to AnchorWatch for a quote and for more details about your security options and coverage. Visit anchorwatch.com today, which is anchorwatch.com. This episode is brought to you by River, the best place for Bitcoiners and businesses to buy Bitcoin. With River, you can set up zero-fee recurring buys, making stacking sats effortless. And while you're waiting for the perfect buying opportunity, River lets you earn daily interest on your cash balance paid in Bitcoin, which outperforms most high-yield savings accounts. What really sets River apart is their unmatched dedication to security. You have peace of mind knowing that River has monthly proof of reserves and holds all Bitcoin in multi-sig cold storage. And with US-based phone support, you'll always have someone ready to help. To open an account, go to river.com/WBD and earn up to $100 in Bitcoin when you buy. That's river.com/WBD.
So this, though, started at like, why will other companies fail? And if you're saying that like small scale, it makes sense to go and do these operations, large scale, does it not make sense that they're now kind of doing both Bitcoin mining and AI compute and high processing compute power? Like, is that a way that those larger miners are going to survive?
I think it's...
because the demand is different all the time for all of those different industries, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And if I happen to be running one of the big companies, I would have pivoted hard toward the AI side.
Yeah.
But I'd also say that I'm probably not a real Bitcoiner.
Fair enough.
Yeah. You know, and that's okay. That's their prerogative.
Yeah.
I would say I'm not here to call out specific people or companies, but I think there's a lot of companies out there that aren't real Bitcoiners that are Bitcoin companies. They claim to be Bitcoin companies, but their complexion will change a lot.
Yeah. But do we need the miners or the hashers to be Bitcoiners? Is that important?
The hashers, I think it's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But we need a large group of real miners.
Yeah.
Because I think what's going to happen, and I don't want to, again, jump too far forward, is that especially the public companies, but there are a couple bigger private ones too, they are going to be targets for acquisition. I guess that's, I'm not a big fan of them. I'll say that.
You've made that very clear.
You know, but you know, to those out there that own stock in them and are, and have been waiting, I think the positive thing I could say to those people is I think they will become acquisition targets, and they will become acquisition targets from the financial services community.
Okay, who are you thinking there? Because like one potentially obvious one, like, because these are very efficient operations generally, like Bitcoin mining is an incredibly competitive industry. Do you think the potential acquirers are people like Google?
It's possible, but I think a more likely candidate is Bank of America or Citigroup or Wells Fargo. Or BlackRock.
And what's their incentive to get into this?
To control block space.
Okay, so this kind of goes full circle to where we're going to get to.
Yes.
So maybe that's a perfect point to kind of go back and get into pools to start with. So is this like your biggest concern in terms of Bitcoin mining centralization?
Pool centralization?
Mm-hmm.
It would be 1A. You know, 1B is probably at the chip level.
Yeah.
But it would be 1A, yeah.
Okay, so why don't we start with you just giving us kind of like an overview of the current situation with the mining pools?
All right. Well, I think I described before. First, as a community, we've largely abdicated the responsibility of mining.
Yeah.
You know, the purpose of a pool originally is to share and mitigate risk.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, and the pools do accomplish that mission. Over time, though, what has happened is they've taken on more and more responsibility. And the community that has been providing hash has been more than willing to do so.
And the reason they've been willing to do so is so they have more reliable payouts. Is that the big driver?
I think more reliable payouts. I think they also have less legal exposure.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real convenient thing to say in a court of law, in a world where maybe a government is attacking you because there's a transaction that
you can
be traced.
You can say, I didn't put this North Korean transaction in the pool.
Right, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Iran bought nukes from North Korea with this transaction, and you happen to include it.
Yeah.
You know, that there's a great way of for the hashers to say, well, hey, wasn't me.
Yeah.
Go talk to the pool.
Yeah.
Of course, as you said, consistency of revenue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think, I think most mining companies are like mine, that we run on a one-month cadence,
yep.
Meaning our cash flow, we have to have consistency in 30-day windows.
To keep all the operations running.
Keep all the operations running properly. And however, some of the mining infrastructure, energy being our big cost, of course, right? Especially when you're on grid. But some mining organizations actually have daily payment requirements, depending on where you are and what your grid relationship is. Some people are buying every single day.
Yeah.
And that kind of pressure really forces you into something that that mitigates it. So what happened was these things kind of migrated. And so now the pool decides what transactions go in the block.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about it more if it's interesting, but it's a great power. If you look at the mempool, which I know is, as we're sitting here today in late April, is empty.
Yep.
There's not much of a decision to make. But we've certainly seen times in the last 2.5 years. Like in the last this is a very interesting stat. In the last 2.5 years, block utilization is over 99%.
Wow.
So for a 2.5 year period, we've been full.
Yeah. Well, mempools, yeah, like you say, didn't empty until quite recently, really.
Right.
So the importance of the transactions in terms of miners' revenues is obviously getting more and more important.
Yeah.
We're getting things like Stratum V2. You guys have Datum. So are we? Is this just a, I guess, like a demand thing where as fees do get more important, miners are going to be more incentivized to have the most expensive fees in the blocks? And so they're going to start pushing to use things like Stratum V2 so they can control that.
Yeah, but it's a lot bigger than that.
Okay. You tell me the story.
Okay. So this is what I was talking about before, about maybe people thinking about these certain equilibriums.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to look at incentives. Now, if you think about mining as an industry of itself and you just think about that in a box, then you'd say, yes, the proper way to answer the question is that way. But if you step back and now let's think forward in time, you know, we're both committed Bitcoiners. We believe there is a point in time, we can argue about what that time frame is, where maybe Bitcoin is the base layer of global money.
Mm-hmm.
It's the final settlement layer for everything. There are 330 million corporations in the world. Let's imagine a world where 10% of those have a Bitcoin treasury. Let's imagine every country having some form of strategic reserve or wealth fund that holds Bitcoin. Well, in that world, the block space becomes insanely, insanely valuable because there's only 53,000 blocks a year. There's roughly 4,000 transactions that we can cram in there. That means there's 200 million base layer transactions that can occur.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if 33 million companies even just want once a quarter to move Bitcoin into their treasury or out of their treasury, that consumes half. Now, could they be batched together and all this? Yes, they could.
Mm-hmm.
But just to give you like an idea,
the direction,
access to these 200 million transactions becomes insanely important.
Yes.
Okay. So now imagine you're a financial institution. Now that could be somebody from the traditional world, like a Wells Fargo or Bank of America, or maybe it could be an emerging one. Maybe Strategy becomes a bank. Maybe Coinbase becomes a bank.
Mm-hmm.
Now you want to attract businesses to bank with you. Well, I believe part of the value proposition for those types of financial institutions, if I'm a big company, I'm General Motors. If I am Strategy as a bank, I'm going to go to General Motors. I'm going to say, I want you to do all your banking with me. And part of my value proposition to you is that I'm going to give you 2,000 base layer transactions a year for free. But you're going to custody with me. You're going to get your Bitcoin loans from me. You're going to do these things with me.
We're going to monetize you elsewhere, but this thing you get for free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's so what I'm saying is, let's zoom out and look at, what is the incentive? The incentive for the bank, they don't give a crap about the fee.
Yeah.
They care about the relationship. And so that changes the whole mindset, right? It as soon as you think that way, you go, well, these are going to be completely different behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
If they have access to block space, for instance, use strategy. Let's say they have 1% of the world's hash power. Well, that means every day they're going to get about 1.5 blocks, mm-hmm. 10 a week, we'll call it 10 a week. So their algorithm for building a block will probably look something like, hey, are there any transactions from our customers?
Pick those first. Yeah.
Are there any of ours? Yeah, pick those next. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a secondary level that maybe the premium customers get it for free, but there's other smaller retailish like customers. Maybe they get a preferential treatment and maybe they even get a discount. Mm-hmm. And then if we haven't filled it up, maybe then we'll go look
at the broader mempool.
Yeah. Right? So it changes the dynamics quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I've talked about this a little bit, but I say if I'm a country, I'm going to have the same set of behaviors. I'll use Israel as an example. So Israel has about 0.5% of the world's GDP. They're a very controversial nation, obviously, right? Mm-hmm. There are, and it pivots whether they're in favor or out of favor at any time.
And even who you speak to in any country.
Yeah, exactly, right? So if I was them, and I think they're pretty good about it, I would be paranoid. Mm-hmm. And I would say, hey, if they can envision a world, even if it's a low percentage chance, where the West suddenly rejects them, and they don't have the US and Australia and the UK and countries like that as friends, how do they survive? Well, if they go out and acquire, let's say, a quarter to 0.5% of the world's hash power.
Yep.
Now.
That should equate to.
Can they get 3 or 4 blocks a week? Well, okay. If so, then they can buy wheat from somebody. They can, you know, buy cars from somebody else. Like they regardless of it. So it's really a path to economic sovereignty. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it at the nation state level, controlling blocks is a preservation of economic sovereignty. And I would go so far as to say, if you don't have long-term economic sovereignty, you probably have no sovereignty as a nation.
For sure.
Right. And so this, I said this to you earlier, and again, I know it's a bit controversial, but I would say if I'm a nation, I'm a lot less concerned about building a treasury of Bitcoin than I am about solidifying my economic sovereignty in the long run. And I get that by controlling block space.
Interesting. This may be a bit of a tangent, but do you think that means we'll see a financialization of block space? I know there's people working on things like block space futures at the moment, or I think there is at least. Do you think to force someone like Strategy to guarantee 2,000 transactions a year to GM or whoever, we need those kind of financialization of block space? And is that then also a risk, or do you not think that's a risk? That's an inevitability?
Great question. I'm actually working on that.
Okay.
So I've been working on it for 2 years.
Yeah.
Because one, I saw this. So I said, well, if block space is scarce, and I believe it, this is a hard concept. Mm-hmm. So as Bitcoiners, for the first 16 years, block space has been available whenever we want for free and for all intents and purposes.
Essentially,
right? You know, so, and even that, some of these things I know are very controversial, but say, well, we have a value proposition to the community about self-custody, which obviously I'm hugely in favor of, mm-hmm. but we can't do it for everybody. The math doesn't work. If there's 200 million transactions a year and there's 8 billion people,
you can't fit them all in.
That's 40 years just to get them Bitcoin, you know, and so that math doesn't really work. So I think that we're at a point where the financialization of block space is inevitable, mm-hmm. because like any scarce resource, an example would be, you know, if you want to go to Times Square on New Year's Eve to see the ball drop, are you going to book your hotel room now here in April, or are you going to show up in New York on December 30th and try to find a hotel room.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. So like any scarce resource, I think block space is the same way. If you're a consumer of block space, that's what you want. Now, if you're a seller of block space, like the hotels, they want to fill the hotel up. And so if they know, they'll jack their prices up now for the last week of December, of course. But they would rather have a full hotel at maybe slightly less than the full market opportunity and know that they're all booked. And miners will be the same way. Mm-hmm. A real miner, right? A real miner meaning somebody that creates block space. So because also as well, if you think about it in Bitcoin terms, anybody that's, whether you're a hasher or a miner, you have had extremely predictable cash flow. And in Bitcoin terms, because you know if you have a certain percentage of the world's hash rate, and you know what the subsidy is, and the subsidy is 98% of the block reward, you know what you're getting. Well, fast forward 10 years. Well, the average block reward since the beginning is 0.335 per block, 0.335 Bitcoin per block from the beginning till now. So by that, assuming that that stays the same, we're three halvings from the fees being 50% of the revenue.
Yeah.
Okay. But again, you don't know what blocks you're going to win, and we'll probably have a lot of variability in that fee structure, just like hotel rooms have a lot of variability, right? So the miners are going to not only want, but almost have to have a marketplace where they can sell forward. And I think users are going to do the same thing. They want to block it in. So I think block space is the next great commodity. So think of it as a commodity. It's a commodity. And I think it's the next great commodity. And I think there'll be a massive market for it.
So just to kind of take this back a little bit. So your concern here on sort of miner centralization is not really anything to do with miners having too much control or pools having too much control and attacking the chain. It's the, or at least directly attacking the chain. It's more on the censorship side.
That's my number one concern. I mean, I think there's always some risk of somebody trying to reorganize the chain or those sorts of things. But I think censorship is the real problem.
Yeah.
But I did gloss over because I have a tendency to do that. Thank you for bringing me back in line. I don't want to overlook that though. We're at a very interesting point. We're at a point right now where Foundry has 30% of the hash rate and Antpool plus its proxies.
Yeah.
And I can come back and explain that, but just think, essentially Antpool has maybe 40-ish percent control, are at a point where we got 70% of the network being processed through two organizations. They decide what transactions go in. They also are in the position for protocol change signaling. So, you know, I mean, obviously there's a relationship between the nodes and the miners about whether something becomes active, but the miners initiate
it. Yeah.
It's usually initiated through the mining, right? So SegWit or Taproot or those sort of things are you know, signaled through those. So we're letting almost the whole decision get made and initiated by two parties. Either is big enough to probably veto it.
Yeah.
You know, or collectively they could decide it. Like it's a very dangerous, very non-democratic way of looking at it. But here's the real thing. Jameson Lopp has a great tool. It's on GitHub. And what it shows is that if I send you money right now, how many blocks should I wait? I'm going to buy your car, Danny, right? Say it's one Bitcoin to buy your car. So it's a big transaction. When should you give me the keys?
Well, so this is funny because like historically people always said an hour, like six blocks. Right. But I did see Luke recently tweet that he thinks the real time is something like 800 blocks.
Correct.
Which is nearly 6 days.
Correct.
And I don't understand that. So can you explain that to me?
Okay. So you're correct. So, and Luke was doing math very similar to what Jameson does in his tool. Mm-hmm. And when somebody has 30% or 40% or 45%, then even though they don't have 51%, which is often thought of as the magical
the key number, yeah,
it's still possible for them to force a reorganization, mm-hmm. right? So, and the way it would be risky. A lot of people would say it's economically unviable.
Yeah.
But I'll go back to the incentives. I think maybe the incentives aren't economic. And so I think that's where a lot of this stuff falls apart. Okay. So basically what could happen is they could say, let's just pretend we're on block number 1 million. Okay. A block gets produced by the network outside of the big guys. And they don't like it for some reason. And Poole doesn't like it for whatever reason. They could wait and try to remine that block.
I think you should explain how this exactly okay. works because I'm not okay. sure I fully understand.
All right. So block number 1 million has been produced, let's say by Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so...
And because it's 1 million, like there's tons of ordinals, people like fees are really high. Oh.
Well, actually, that's probably, I hadn't thought of that. I was trying to do that for simplicity's sake, but you're probably right. It's probably a magic number. Fees are through the roof. So that's a great example. Yeah. Let's say for some reason that there's 1,000 Bitcoin in fees mm-hmm. sitting there. Okay. So Ocean mines it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you go look at mempool.space and you see the Ocean tag, buy it. But Antpool doesn't have to accept it. Their mm-hmm. node could say, we're rejecting that. We're going to keep trying to mine that same block, 1 million.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And let's say somebody else, let's say Demand Pool's out there now. Okay. Demand Pool got one. They got 1 million and one. Okay. And Poole could say, we're going to ignore that one too. We're still trying to mine number 1 million. Okay. You could go on and on and on. Okay. And let's say And Poole's having this amazing run of bad luck. Okay. But they just keep trying to mine. Well, but now they have to mine not only number 1 million, they have to catch up to the chain. They have to mine 1 million, 1 million one, 1 million two, 1 million three.
Because longest chain is all that matters.
We'll come back to that. It's not exactly true. But,
okay.
But for this purpose, we're gonna use that. So eventually, if they could mine, and let's just keep it simple. They get to the point where the chain is now on 1,000,010, and they catch up and mine 1,000,011, and they present to the network 11 blocks. All mined by Antpool, and they steal the fees from all the ordinal inscription bullshit,
mm-hmm.
and then they and maybe they disregard certain transactions, maybe including the one where I bought your car.
Mm.
And now that one's not confirmed. Now, would it likely get picked up and actually conclude? Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. So I don't want to overly scare people with this. But we are at a point now where most of the wallet construction is set up for 2 to 6.
Yeah.
And most people's behavior is set up for 2 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we have the ecosystem at a point where those are far from the reliable numbers. So short term, my advice would be, I mean, if I'm buying your bike for $250, don't worry about it. $250 worth of Bitcoin. But if I'm buying your car, if I'm purchasing several hundred thousand dollars of goods from a supplier in China or something like that, that transaction should should be waiting a long time. Now, mm-hmm. I'm probably not with Luke at 800 right now, although mathematically he can support that. It's as everyone goes by, it's a lower and lower probability. He's trying to give you at like a 99.9% confidence number that it can no longer be done. Interesting little tidbit. I think it's the technical thing about what chain is viable is actually what chain has the most proof of work, not the longest chain.
Now, okay.
It would tend to be the longest chain, mm-hmm. but it's a mechanism that says probably more deeper than we'll want to go.
No, I'm interested though, because I don't know if I fully understand this. So why would the longest chain not have the most proof of work?
Okay. Let me see if I can come up with an example. Let's say the scenario we were talking about occurred. Mm-hmm. Okay. So chain A is the one where Ocean mined the millionth block and continued on. And chain B is Antpool marching along.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have 60% of the network hashing to chain A and 40% hashing to chain B.
Yeah.
So now let's say that something catastrophic happens, like there's a grid failure in the US.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of 60% of the hash power on chain A, it's it drops to 1% of what it was. And so now Antpool has a massive amount of the world's hash.
Because they may have fewer miners in the US, they're elsewhere. And,
right.
Yeah.
I'm assuming it's maybe, you know, okay. So if what they did was they said, oh, what we're going to do is in this period of great weakness, mm-hmm. we're not going to just try to go back to a million. Yeah. We're going to go way the hell back.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll start at the Genesis block, like, and we're going to try to reorganize
the entire chain.
The entire chain. Okay. Well, what would happen is, and maybe they, I haven't done the math. Please take the, anybody out there that's I haven't done all the math. I'm communicating conceptual.
Yeah.
You know, they could try to reorganize the whole chain, but with a much lower difficulty level.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so they're rebuilding the whole chain, but with a much lower difficulty level. And they could also do some manipulation of timestamps and some stuff like that to try to fool the network. So what would happen though is they could have built a longer chain, but that had less proof of work attributed to it. So what we want in the way the network is now built is it's technically not the longest chain, it's the chain that has the most proof of work associated with it. So you're basically looking at how much work went into each block along the way, not just the longest
one. So in that example, that wouldn't work because even though the other chain's shorter, it would have more proof of work, so that would be the valid chain.
Yeah.
I see.
Okay. At least for a while, right?
Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, there's one thing I want to just pick you up on, which I think is worth explaining more, which is Antpool having close to 50%, including their proxies. Just for anyone listening who doesn't know what their proxies are, do you want to explain how like F2Pool and these things kind of fall into the same bucket?
Okay, so this goes back to the way miners get paid. So miners, hashers, even I screw up my term. The hashing community has largely wanted consistency in payment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But if you're a public company, that's a pretty important thing too.
Yeah.
Cause it, you know, I think if you're a public company, imagine going to your quarterly announcement and saying, well, we had really bad luck this particular, you know, and I think that that's one of the key reasons why, in other words, by being bad luck, meaning they didn't win as many blocks as they expected.
Yeah.
By the way, my hat's off to the Marathon guys, which I don't 100% agree with them on everything philosophically, but they are a real miner. They create their own blocks. They do those things. So, you know, my hat's off to them for that.
Mm-hmm.
And they take that risk. But, you know, one of the things that happens is when you get to a certain size, that risk starts to get pretty small.
Because you're going to win blocks.
because you're going to win a certain amount of blocks. And yeah, there's some variance. You might have good ones and bad ones, but the variance goes away. So what has happened, though, is that a method called FPPS, full pay per share, came about. And what it means is that the pool basically says, we're going to pay you every 10 minutes. Every time a block gets mined, whether we win it or not, we're going to pay you for the work
that you put into
it. You put into it attempting to mine the block.
Yeah.
Okay. So your share of that. Okay. And they have a formula for determining what that number should be.
Just like very quick side point. Do all the pools offer the same amount?
Our stats say no.
Okay.
That they're very black box-ish.
Yeah.
Okay. So you, to my knowledge at this point, none of the FPPS pools will tell you like what, if I start hashing one of my machines to that pool, and I do use them to a small degree. Mm-hmm. I'm not 100% ocean. Part of it is so that I can collect data,
yeah,
by the way. but there are other reasons. I don't hate all the people in all these places, right? That they in determining what the payout method should be, there's two components. So one is, what is the formula? The formula typically is, let's look back at the previous day, the previous 144 blocks. We're going to throw out some of the high fee ones and some of the low fee ones, and then average the rest.
Okay.
So that's partly the formula. But the second side is, but nobody knows for sure. Like, they don't publish, we're throwing out these ones from the high and the low. Okay. The second thing that they don't publish is, what percent of the pool are you?
Mm-hmm.
So you can only guess. So I think I'm 0.5% of the pool, and my payout should be about X, but yeah, you don't really know. So, which I find fascinating, because in a Bitcoin world, this is partly why I say I don't believe there's a lot of true Bitcoiners in a lot of the management, because we're inherently don't trust verify people. Right? I think that's an inherent attribute, at least of,
for sure,
the, you know, and so their entire income stream is kind of in this
trust don't verify.
Mm. Now, I know that at points in times the big companies are able to go in and do some audits and do some things, but it's very un-Bitcoin-y, like, to, in my opinion. So what happens, though, is, now imagine you are a pool. Okay, so this payout method occurs. The risk is entirely on the pool. So if you're a small pool, you still have this luck factor. Are you going to win? Are you going to lose? But you owe the money. Okay. And mathematically, almost some of the stuff we were talking about before, you'll find that the amount of Bitcoin that you need to have in reserve as a pool is phenomenal, because you can have a massive run of bad luck,
yeah,
and you still have to pay all the folks, right? You know, like, I've been in Vegas and watched guys lose like 12 or 15 hands of blackjack in a row, right? We've probably all seen.
Yeah, same thing can happen with mining.
Yeah, same thing can happen with mining. And there are cases, you know, for instance, the Titan Pool and Poolin both ran into this problem where they ran out of money.
Interesting.
And went belly up.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the way that that's been mitigated, to get to the answer to the question you asked me a minute ago, is the way to do that is to have essentially the equivalent of the Federal Reserve, a bank of last resort.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a small pool, what you can do is if you have a big brother like Antpool that will sit behind you and say, well, if we don't win some on a certain basis,
back us up.
You back us up.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is clearly happened, because we can manage this, as we can see that those relationships exist. There's about 11 pools that all are running Ant Pool templates. So, okay. So what happens is they're running the same templates. The Coinbase transaction is paying the money to a common place.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you're using pool A, B, C, D, when that pool wins, the money goes to the same place and they have the same templates. So which are all can be tied back to Antpool. So that lets us know that Antpool is controlling that amount.
This episode is also brought to you by Ledger. If you're serious about protecting your Bitcoin, Ledger has the solution you need. Their hardware wallets give you complete control over your private keys, ensuring that your Bitcoin stays safe from hacks, phishing, and malware. With Ledger's easy-to-use devices and the Ledger Live app, managing your Bitcoin has never been more convenient. Whether you're a long-time holder or new to the world of Bitcoin, Ledger makes it simple to keep your assets protected. If you want to find out more, visit ledger.com and secure your Bitcoin today. That's ledger.com. This episode is brought to you by Casa, the leading Bitcoin self-custody solution. I've been using Casa since 2019, and I can't recommend them enough. Casa have options for all Bitcoiners, from a 2-of-3 multisig to a 3-of-5 and a private client option for absolute best-in-class security. Casa also do inheritance, which I very recently set up, and it really couldn't be easier. My inheritance plan has gone from a vague treasure map for my wife to a rock-solid security plan that I have total confidence in. To find out more about Casa, go to casa.io, which is casa.io.
And so of the big pools, obviously we don't need to get into them all, but who are the ones that are essentially the proxy pools? Is it like F2 pool, Brains?
Well, the big ones would be, well, Antpool, Binance, BTC, .com, Brains is in there. Trying to remember some of the other ones off the top of my head.
But it makes up close to 50%.
40-ish.
Yeah. Okay. And so you laid out this sort of future scenario where there's the incentive for certain transactions to be in blocks, and block space is obviously incredibly scarce. To bring that to like a today example, we've seen pools try and do like OFAC compliance in blocks. Foundry tried this, I believe.
Marathon did.
Marathon tried this. That was like pretty politically within Bitcoin unpopular, and they got a lot of pushback and stopped doing that. Do you think this will get to a point where even with a lot of pushback, we won't be able to stop these pools from doing this kind of thing?
Yes. I think it will be just because very difficult.
The monetary incentive is too strong.
The monetary incentive is too strong, but even more so, I think it comes back to risk. Mm-hmm. Just like I talked about before.
Yeah.
If you're... I think in the current administration, I mean, it's hard. It's really hard to say.
This is speculation.
It's very, you know, but if you're Foundry, at some point I would expect somebody to knock on your door and say,
you know, one of us now.
Yeah. And the truth of the matter is that the economic loss is probably trivial for a long time.
Interesting.
It's probably a small list. Yeah. So the economic incentive doesn't go away, but the threat
that's real
is real, right? So they unless they structure themselves completely differently. Now, I do think what's going to happen though is you know, like Ocean is set up completely differently.
Yeah, we should talk about the payouts that Ocean do with Tides.
Yeah. So with Tides, if you're a miner of any size, even a moderate one, you get your payment directly from the Coinbase. Mm-hmm. So part of this too is like chain of custody. Again, kind of that whole trust thing too. So if you're in a big pool, like a Foundry, they're paying you, but the where the money comes from, nobody knows.
Yeah.
Okay. When you're with Ocean, you're getting a payment directly from the Coinbase transaction, or it's actually Virgin Bitcoin, which by the way, I found a private market for that. It's small, but there are people that will pay a premium for that Bitcoin.
I can believe it. I mean, I think they've existed in the past too. I don't like the idea of them.
Yeah.
Because it kind of creates this strange incentive where you have almost like black market and white market Bitcoin.
Oh, it does. Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit of a fungibility-ish issue. Like, as well.
But I'm sure it exists. I can totally believe it exists.
I get approached, I don't want to say every day my phone's ringing off the hook, but I get approached from people that say, hey, can I buy a couple Bitcoin from you? But I want some that I know came directly from, that has no history other than your payment from the Coinbase transaction.
And they're doing that because presumably they don't want to be associated with North Korea or Iran, whoever it is. It's not because it's just non-KYC Bitcoin that they're trying to buy.
I think they're trying to minimize the paths to themselves.
Okay.
You know, that history, they want no history. I don't know
I don't
all
mind
of
that
their
as
incentives.
Much, then.
Yeah, I don't know all of their incentives.
But is the idea of like coins that North Korea, just as an example of touch being like dirty Bitcoin, that's the part I don't like. If it's more on like a KYC point, I don't mind that nearly as much.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, there's a great way for North Korea to wash, which is to become a miner.
Mm.
So what they do is they take their Bitcoin, put it in a transaction that pays themselves almost all fees.
Mm.
They don't broadcast it to the world, so nobody else can pick
it
up. When they finally win a, yeah, and then when they win a block finally, they pay it to themselves through the Coinbase transaction, right? So it's probably the ultimate wash technique. So the way Tides works is this: if you contribute to Ocean, you contribute hash rate to Ocean, then you earn shares and your shares and everybody else's shares are public at all times. You always know what percent of the pool you are, what percentage of the hash you have, and also what's called the share percentage. So you get paid, in simplistic terms, you get paid when you work on a block, you're going to get paid out for that block over the next 8 blocks that are won by Ocean. Okay. And so you always know at current time what share of the next block you are entitled to and what percentage of the current hash rate you are. So you can audit these numbers. Then when you get paid, you're going to get paid directly from the Coinbase transaction. But you only get paid when we win a block.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have to take the risk. Now, in the early days of Ocean, which we're about 18 months in now, being public, it was hard.
Yeah. It took a while for you guys to win a block.
Well, actually, we won one right away.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. In fact, I won it.
Really?
So I was a little sidelight. And for full disclosure, in case it hasn't come out already, I'm on the board of directors at Ocean. I'm an investor in Ocean. I'm very active with the Ocean team. But I was the first company to sign up to contribute hash rate to it. And so I lit up first. I think it was like only like 20 or 30 petahash, a tiny amount that I lit up. And amazingly, we won a block like 2 days after. I mean, statistically, I think it was supposed to be like 18 days till we won one, and we won one right away. Huge payout, by the way. It was really, it was really good. Because there was nobody else there. It was almost like mining. It was almost like a solo block. You know, so it was wonderful for us. But you always, so there's always that transparency that you know, and then we get the Coinbase transaction. What it also means is Ocean is not in the chain of custody. You're not trusting Ocean to pay you, you're trusting the Bitcoin network to pay you.
Yeah.
And without going into too much of it, I think, you know, where Ocean is as well is, you know, we want others to create the block template. We are there as a sharing mechanism. The true spirit of
mining,
which is to share risk. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, we want you to create your own block template, which in fact we give you a discount if you do. The fees are 1% if you control your own template, create your own template through Datum, or 2% if you use one of the ones we have.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know you did that.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, from day two where you won a block, how long did it then take you to win the next one?
And we won another one like 3 or 4 days later, and then it was like a month.
Oh, okay, okay.
so it all averaged back out.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, but we, you know, those, the first year was hard.
Yeah.
Because like during the halving, we had our worst run of luck. Like the 2 weeks preceding the halving when fees went nuts, we like won nothing.
And that's just purely down to luck.
Just luck, It's just luck. But now what's happened is we've grown to roughly 6.5 exahashes.
Nice.
which puts us a little less than 1% of the world's hash rate. Mm-hmm. It's just enough to expect one block a day, though.
Okay.
So now, and you know, we might win three in a day and then go 2 days without, but
average out.
Yeah. So it's provided that, at least from my perspective now, it's really helped.
And with Tides as opposed to FPPS, is the payout smaller or larger? Or is it? Does it work out very similar?
My statistics, I've been running a controlled study for, actually it preceded even Ocean. It goes back over 2 years where mm-hmm. what happened was I was running on different pools. And I'm not here to call out any pool, but I was running on these different pools, which all claim to use FPPS, but in this black box that I told you about. But what I was finding was I was making different amounts of money with the same amount of hash. Saying, why is this happening? And I better understand this. So what I did was I took 10 units, identical units. They're actually S19J Pro 120s. Loaded them into the same container, same internet connection, same everything. Put them right side by side. And then connected those to different pools. Mm-hmm. And I started saying, well, let me see what the actual payout is. And I've been running this study consistently since then. And then when Ocean launched, I put 10 of the same right beside those. So my statistics have shown, it's almost from the beginning, which by the way includes some massively good luck at the beginning, like I said.
But then some bad luck.
But then some bad luck. But we were, I'm going off the top of my head, it's a double digit, I'll just say that. It's a double digit percentage improvement of Ocean compared to all the others.
Wow.
From the beginning. Now, if I measure, I review this every week with my team. We measure 30 day, 60 day, 90 day, 180 day. Mm-hmm. The band gets much tighter.
But it's normally you get more paid out through Ocean than you would do using one of these other pools.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So why do you think more people aren't using that then?
I think there's several reasons. We'll talk about the big guys first. So the big guys, there's still this variability, number one. Number two.
You'd have thought most of the big guys could probably weather that variability though.
Well, amazingly, yes. But I don't think they...
Because most of them have a lot of cash in the bank.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. They do. But I think that's still one problem mm-hmm. is they're scared of variance. Two, they have concerns about how the... taking on the responsibility of like template creation, mm-hmm. like, and what exposure that presents to them. I think that's a fearful thing. And
yeah.
We didn't talk about it today, but I was a C-suite executive in a Fortune 200 company.
Yeah.
And I've been in the meetings where, and I was the technology guy, right? You know, so it's usually the technology guy and the marketing and sales group. We tend to be aggressive.
Yeah, butting heads
with the finance and legal guys on the other side who are very conservative. And depending on who's in charge, like who you know, it's kind of like the politics to a certain degree. It is politics, frankly.
Yeah.
And the conservatives and the liberals almost like, you know, and the power swings in an organization. But I have a feeling in most of these big organizations, they're led by finance kind of people.
Yeah.
And they just don't want the risk mm-hmm. like of, you know, like Ocean, because now there's absolutely no control, by the way, because you're part of a pool that could mine anything.
Yeah.
Right. Because that's Ocean. Pretty much all of us are very like anti-spam, anti-inscriptions. You know, we would be.
But you do mind them.
Because what we say, and like I said, Luke, who's the CEO and founder, is very much supportive of this, and I am too. I'd say we believe that block template creation is essentially analogous to the First Amendment.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And so you combine with Ocean and you can speak however you wish. Mm-hmm. And we would rather you speak about something even that we are completely philosophically opposed to.
Yeah.
And express it through your template creation, then have you abdicate that responsibility and let some centralized organization speak for you.
Well, you personally, being someone who's against ordinals and inscriptions, do you mind them?
No.
You exclude those from all of your blocks?
Correct.
How do you kind of justify that to the business when you're leaving revenue on the table?
Because I've run the numbers. It's trivial.
Okay. Interesting. So one thing that I want to touch on before we close is to get back to the nation state thing. Because Trump obviously came out and said he wants to mine all the Bitcoin. I'm curious what you think. First of all, I mean, you could probably throw that comment away, but more generally, what do you think the US is going to do? Do you think they'll want to step in and actually control some hash rate? Or do you think they're just going to allow companies in the US to kind of flourish and do it that way?
I think in the short term, they will let the market go. I think a point will come. I think it will come faster than probably others think. But where the nation state control over block space becomes more prevalent. But I think it will come because I used Israel as an example. There are going to be announcements like Israel is controlling block space.
Yeah.
I'm quite confident Russia already controls block space. Mm-hmm. Iran controls block space. North Korea controls block space. And I think as the idea that blocks are being produced by these other nation states comes out, that it will, to a certain degree, some of what I believe is consistent with what Jason Lowry believes. We're not the same. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at it very much from a Bitcoin and economics perspective. He looks at it from, you know, the hash war kind of perspective. But there is an overlap in this thought process. And I think that whether it's coming from the DOD or whether it's coming out of Treasury or someplace like that, it will happen. Like they will realize they need some control. I also think what will happen as these nation states come up in mining, they probably won't broadcast it.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll probably see, when you look at the mempool and you see the block, you know, who won the block, you're going to start seeing an increase in unknown.
Interesting.
And that at some point...
That's the signal.
At some point...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they will go from being unknown to being known at some point.
Well, yeah. And well, I think you'll start to... You'll start to see that maybe they're including a lot of transactions that weren't broadcast, that were, you know, out of band in those.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, forensically, you know, there's some guys that love doing that stuff and I appreciate their work. And I think we'll kind of uncover some of that. But like Russia has been very, very straightforward that they are using Bitcoin for commerce, for trade. And you know, some of my thoughts about this solidified around when Biden kicked Russia off of
100%.
Yeah.
That was the clearest indicator that they need to use something that is not US Treasuries.
Right.
And what else is there? Are they going to start shipping gold around the world? You can't do that very covertly. Right.
But it's not, but this is the difference. It's not so much owning the Bitcoin, it's controlling.
It's transacting it.
It's because you could own all the Bitcoin in the world, but if you have no control over the block creation, you can't move it.
Yeah.
So you
we can't guarantee you can move it at the right time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's what changed. And the complete fuck up by the Biden administration is, but it's classic politician stuff, not thinking about second and third order effects is, you didn't hurt Russia and force them into this. You just signaled to the 220-ish countries around the world that on a whim,
this could happen.
This could happen to you.
Yeah.
And the thing about Bitcoin, as you well know, is that you don't overnight just become like a major miner. Mm-hmm. Like that's why my advice to, if I was giving advice to nation states, it would be go step up and go get probably at least 0.25% or even 0.1% is probably enough to have some level, like, and be absolutely sure that you can, on a moment's notice, control that block space.
Yeah.
Like, that's like the bare minimum. As a Bitcoiner, I don't like it.
Yeah, I was going to say, what would your advice be as a Bitcoiner?
As a Bitcoiner, I don't like it. But my advice also, this is kind of sitting on two sides of it. My advice to big financial institutions is exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Like, you better have access to block space and control it so that your viability as a financial institution is stable as we transition into this Bitcoin world. Because if you wait for it, you'll be too late. Like, you're not going to be able to go from 0 to a quarter of the world's hash rate, a quarter of a 1% of the world's hash rate, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now. We'll have X zeta hashes. It just won't be something you can scale. And if you're in trouble, like, because you're economically boycotted from the rest of the world, and you're 18 to 24 months away from having any reasonable amount of hash rate, you're screwed.
Yeah. That also raises another interesting part, which I know you spoke about right at the start, is what happens to hardware? Because the vast majority of that is manufactured in China and Taiwan. I know maybe sort of back end of last year, there were rumors that some of that was being stopped at the border here. I'm not sure if you know anything about that or why that was happening. And then also, like, a second part of that, do you think tariffs are going to make that trade of, like, ASICs from China to the US much harder? And then how does that kind of then escalate again?
There's a lot there. the issue last year was about a specific chip. It wasn't it was a chip that was going on some of the control boards from a banned company.
Okay.
So it wasn't a mining specific thing.
Okay.
But it just so happened that Bitmain and MicroBT were on several models using this chip. And so that caused that problem. The tariffs have been an absolute pain in the ass.
Yeah. Have they basically just stopped shipping?
I mean, they've been in windows. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's limited amount of supply in the US that was already here in front of the tariffs. That got gobbled up. I'll say, you know, we went out and bought some a little ahead of where we were going to, mm-hmm. just because of that. And we knew we needed it in like 60 days.
Yeah.
And I hated it because I we're careful with our cash. We don't want to use our cash too soon. And we went out and, you know, bought some stuff we wouldn't have bought for a few months.
And did you pay a premium on that as well? Was the demand high?
No, but that's probably just relationships.
Okay.
You know, that at this point we had good relationships but certainly if this thing continues on, then that will be big. The market for used equipment suddenly got a little more,
I can imagine,
appetizing. The long term, we're not even 100% clear. We just had a conversation yesterday, still weren't 100% clear whether or not the tariffs would be in effect. Trump's come out and said, it shouldn't affect chips and computers.
Okay.
Are what we use computers or not? And
I think so, but I don't know.
I think so too. That's a whole different
topic.
Depending on time we could go into. So we're not sure. So we're kind of sitting here in this quandary. We have some expansion opportunities and we don't know what to do because they're US based. In the absence of that, there's a wonderful opportunity outside the US. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, if Trump's objective is to mine all the Bitcoin, which is a terrible objective, but if it is, then he's creating the opposite effect right now.
And then if China wake up to this idea, maybe they've already woken up to this idea that they need a certain amount of hash power, do you think there could also be kind of sort of global trade wars in the sense that they may be like, don't send this to the US until we've got what we want set up? Do you think that's probably going too far?
I don't think we're there now. Mm-hmm. I think that could happen in the future. And we do have that problem, like the ASIC issue, ASIC specifically meaning the chip.
Yeah.
One of those things I'm also kind of vigilant about is in terminology is, you know, the ASIC is the chip. Mm-hmm. And I like the term system or server to describe the entire unit that performs the hashing function. Well, those chips, at the end of the day, right now what we have is we have a world where essentially the designers of the chips and the producers of the chips are all overseas. We're hopefully at a point where we're going to see more Western design stuff. Brains, for instance, I have a great relationship with the Brains guys. They've just come out with their little kind of prototype that they've announced that they have a chip. I've been working for a year and a half with a group called M5ers, which is a group of ex-Samsung and Intel guys, and we've been working to develop our own ASIC. Mm-hmm. Block and Blockstream have initiatives. I think these are really, I'm rooting for everybody, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, kind of.
There were rumors of Intel doing something as well a few years ago.
Well, no, they did. They absolutely did. And we've actually seen the chips and played with systems based on them, but they pulled out.
But then they canned it, yeah.
Which had nothing to do with Bitcoin. It had to do with problems inside their own organization.
Okay.
And Bitcoin is still
of course,
tiny, tiny thing. And they're in a bad situation. They had to cut costs and it's unfortunate because they could have really helped. But right now, like even the chip I'm working on, we ultimately, right now, we have no choice but to rely on either Samsung and or TSMC to build the chips for us. So now, in the space of the next 5 to 7 years, the hope would be that we would have some U.S. options. Mm. But it's not just U.S. fabrication that's necessary. Like I can say this about our chip, like the new machines come out, have ASICs that are largely built on 3-nanometer technology.
Yeah.
Okay, we've gone 7, then 5, then 3. So the next iteration is 2. Mm-hmm. And so if you're where we are as a company, you skip 3, we're not trying to get 3 out because we're a 2026-ish come to market thing, we have to be at 2.
Yeah.
So we have to leap to that. So then the question is, well, will new fabs come up in the US, but will new fabs that are at the absolute bleeding edge come up? And that's, I'm not so sure of.
Yeah. They did spin up a chip manufacturer pretty quickly, didn't they? Was it in Arizona or somewhere like that?
Yeah. I think, are you talking about the Intel facility and then there's a TSMC facility?
It
and
was
there's
the TSMC one I was thinking of.
Supposed to be going up in Ohio as well.
Are they behind Taiwan though?
That's what I don't know for sure. I'm not sure where they are, but you know, what we'll need is if in 2026 we have the 2-nanometer stuff, I'm not sure we're even going, we're probably at 1.5 in 2028 or something like that. So,
and then there's nowhere to go though, presumably, once you get to 1, like what else can happen?
Well, we'll see. I mean, I started doing, so Moore's Law, which is what this is based on, you know, as an old guy in the computing industry. You know, in 1986, we were concerned it was running out of gas. Mm-hmm. I'll put it that way. Like, so 40 years ago, we were already worried. Like, is it running out of gas? Where could it possibly go? Sub 100 nanometers was like, wow. Like, you know, I mean, that's where we were, you know, our minds were blown by that sort of 70 nanometers. Like, I remember this sort of stuff happening and keeps going. I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't bet against it at this point, given history.
Yeah. Fair enough. Well, Bob, this has been amazing. If we had to like summarize this conversation, what do you want people to care about? Because you obviously talk about this a lot. Like, what do you want people to leave this with?
I think the first thing I said today was about complacency. Mm-hmm. That we have to stay vigilant. And this certain amount of paranoia, I think, is really important. I call it 10th man mentality, which comes from the movie World War Z is a zombie mm-hmm. movie. And there's a great scene.
It's a great movie.
Yeah. Do you remember The Tenth Man?
I don't remember exactly what that was.
So what happens in the movie is Brad Pitt, who's kind of the main character, is a United Nations agent.
Yeah.
And so he's trying to find where is the virus coming from that's causing the zombies. And mm-hmm. he finds out that Jerusalem has had a massive wall built around it.
Yeah.
And they've got no zombies.
Yeah.
So he flies to Jerusalem and he speaks to the head of Israeli security. He says, well, how did you know to build the wall that kept all the zombies out? And the guy says, well, it's because of the 10th man. And he explains that during the 1972 Munich Olympics, the Israeli Security Council had warnings that there might be an attack. And the entire council kind of disregarded them as frivolous. You know? And then there were other major incidents, wars and bombings and things that in Israel's history they had neglected.
Mm-hmm.
So they created what's called the 10th man. And the 10th man is that the Israeli Security Council had 10 people in it. And so the procedure was if nine members of the, if the Security Council is presented with a threat and the first nine members all disregard it instantly, it's imprudent on the 10th
to fight
for, even if he thinks it's not a threat too. Huh. Like he has to be the devil's advocate and build a case as to why they should take the threat seriously. So, and he was, of course, the 10th man,
mm-hmm.
and he advocated for building the wall, and it at least for temporarily saved Jerusalem.
Yeah, so, until they got over the wall.
Yeah, until they got over the wall, which, yeah, whole different thing. But the point is, like, I did a little, my little show, it's called Old Man Yells. I did an episode on this and said, I've taken upon myself to make sure I always try to be the 10th man.
Mm-hmm.
And so when everybody else is happy, I'm the one saying, don't be too confident. Don't, you know, to try yeah. to try to be the contrarian, not to bring people down. Cause I mean, very optimistic.
No, it's an important role though.
I'm very, very optimistic about Bitcoin, but it doesn't just happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, interestingly, this movie, not that, you know, World War Z, which is actually a zombie movie, but I absolutely love it. There's a second learning in there, which is if you watch the movie, what you'll find is the way that they fight the virus. Do you remember this? Like what happens is they find that the virus only seeks healthy hosts.
That's right. Because they're walking past the ill people in the hospital.
Right.
Yeah.
So they find they can beat the virus by giving people a disease and they become immune to the zombie virus. And so it's kind of a lesson on Achilles' heel too. Like your weakness might come out of left field.
Mm-hmm.
Like it might be something you completely didn't see. Like the fact that a virus seeks a healthy host is actually ended up being the downfall of that. And sorry for anybody who hasn't seen the movie yet.
Yeah,
completely
spoilers.
Wrecked it. Spoiler alert. But I think that that's very, very important. And so if we look at like the word HODL, mm-hmm. okay, it's a battle cry within our community. But I think even that there's a bit of danger in the word HODL, because I think it implies buy Bitcoin, sit and do nothing, and you're going to get rich.
Yeah.
Well, if everybody HODLs, And takes that approach, though it's a non-participatory approach to Bitcoin, then we get nothing,
mm-hmm.
right? Like Bitcoin requires participation. And I would be of the mindset that, you know, you have to use Bitcoin a little bit too.
For sure.
You know, I want you to HODL. I want you to have a big stash, but I want you to use it, you know, participate in the network, do something for the network. Because I think we should think of Bitcoin much like we think of being citizens. Like if you're a citizen of a country and you don't vote, you don't run for office, you're unwilling to serve in the military, you're going to turn the other way whenever anything bad happens. You're just going to kind of ignore it and pretend it's all hunky-dory. Eventually that society and country will collapse. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the same with Bitcoin. Like, we have to participate. We have to be vigilant. We have to be willing to voice our opinion. Otherwise, it will fail.
I love that. I totally agree. Okay, so where do you want to send anyone? We've got Old Man Yells, Barefoot, and Ocean.
I'm Twitter at BoomerBTC, Boomer_BTC, and that should do it.
I really appreciate the time, Bob. Thank you. That was great.
Thank you, Danny.